And so you might say, I've got good news and I got bad news. The good news is this is one of the biggest paradigm shifts in the treatment of psychosis and arguably in psychopharmacology in 70 years. The bad news is that you've never heard of it before, and it'll take a few times going through this before you really master it. So you have to come to the NEI Congress and leave with some of the most cutting-edge stuff, and at least I will guarantee that you've gone through the first stage of my bad jokes about the three stages of learning. The first stage, if you walked in here and you didn't know this, that's called an unconscious incompetent. You didn't even know you didn't know it. Well, guess what? If you read the title, you're already past the first stage of learning because now you know you don't know it. And that's called a conscious incompetent. But just like myself, when I went through this process, it took several times through this information before I became a conscious competent, which means you have to work at it, go through it 3 times, 10 times. That's why we give you a handout. I'm only going to give the highlights of the slides. Some of them I'll skip. But it's not going to go away. And so as these drugs come out in the next probably 2 years, you have heard about it, and you know, that's what you come here, hear about it first. And then eventually become easy, and then you become an unconscious competent, which is it's just easy as pie, you don't even have to think about it anymore. So those are the stages of learning. We're starting that process now. And so we're gonna get to work, but it's very exciting. And the learning objectives of this talk are to introduce trace amines. You've heard of monoamines, how about a trace amine? And how they interact with neurotransmitters, yet are not themselves really neurotransmitters. But what the heck are they? We're going to explain the neurobiology of them in a very brief way and how they can alter neurotransmission without actually doing the neurotransmission. But we're still exploring exactly what the heck they do. And one of the best ways to do that, of course, is put a drug in there that either mimics it or blocks it, and then you can find out what happens when you have more of it or less of it, and then you learn. And so that's happened. So we're going to, in order to explain therapeutic actions in schizophrenia, we're going to show how dopamine is reduced by stimulating one of the trace amine receptors. And this could explain two things. I hate to do this to you, but I'm going to do it anyway. Two terms that you can get a hold of. It's not that bad. It's new stuff in pharmacology. Heterodimerization and biased agonism. All right, so let's go in. What the heck, Dr. Stahl, is a trace amine? Why are you putting me through this at 5:30 or 4:30 on a Saturday night? You got to be nuts. But it's new. They're formed in trace concentrations. That's why they're called trace amines. They're almost not there. And it's from the amino acid tyrosine when you admit one of the enzyme steps from tyrosine hydroxylase. I'll show you a couple of pictures of structures. So it's almost like a regular neurotransmitter, but it's missing one little hydroxy group on it. Or it's the same thing when you emit tryptophan hydroxylase. And as you know, tyrosine hydroxylase makes dopamine and norepinephrine. So there's trace amines that are analogs of those. And tryptophan hydroxylase makes serotonin. So there's analogs of those. So what are they? Well, the main ones in humans are PEA, phenethylamine or beta phenethylamine, tyramine. You know, good old tyramine makes your blood pressure go up, right? Octopamine. Guess why it's called that? Because it was first discovered in an octopus. Synephrine, which is very much similar to the stuff you put in your nose for nasal spray. And tryptamine, that's the one that's kind of like serotonin. Those are the most important ones. There's a bunch more. We don't have to talk about all of them. But if you look at phenethylamine at the top, compared to the tyramine next to it, it's got a little hydroxy group on the bottom. And the tyramine. So if you go down to the second tier and look at dopamine, the only difference between dopamine and tyramine is what? Dopamine's got 2 hydroxys and tyramine just has 1. That's the only difference. And so it doesn't have the second hydroxy group because it bypasses that one enzyme I told you about, tyrosine hydroxylase, so forth and so on. And their structure related not only to those monoamine neurotransmitters like on the left, dopamine, which actually is called 3-hydroxytyramine, same thing, and beta-phenethylamine in the middle. Look at amphetamine. Amphetamine is a phenethylamine. And look at good old parnate, tranylcypramine. So these are related to some drugs that you know and love. So what's the story of tracheamines? It's over 100 years old. And they're originally classified as false neurotransmitters because they didn't look like the real neurotransmitters. They thought maybe, who knows why they were there, but they were thought to be kind of a neurotransmitter. However, guess what? In invertebrates, these things are major neurotransmitters, not tracheamines. So invertebrates, but also in your gut. So you have more of your tracheamines in your gut than you do in your brain. And there's all sorts of receptors for these things, but humans have a few of the receptors, but really the TAR1 is the one that's in abundance and is the one that we have drugs for. So they've been around a long time, we just haven't known what they've done. It's present in food, of course, seafood, cured meats, wine, cheese, a tyramine reaction of cheese, remember that? A chocolate, significant amounts. So we eat it, but our MAO normally destroys it and it never gets anywhere. But sometimes they're already being synthesized in your own neurons, in your own brain. So, what about neurotransmission and these funny things? Well, they're present at such low concentrations in a mammalian brain that they don't really neurotransmit. They're not stored in synaptic vesicles. They just float around in the cytoplasm. And the receptors do too. The receptors are not in the membrane where you see all the ones that we always talk about. They're floating. And they're inactive, essentially, and they're so low in concentrations that they don't even get eaten by MAO. And when you fire the nerve, depolarize it, they don't get released. What the heck are they doing there? So they can be false neurotransmitters. Why? Because they are transported by the dopamine transporter, DAT, the norepinephrine transporter, NET, the serotonin transporter, SERT, and by the vesicular monoamine transporter. So the brain does use kind of like hijacks, or if you will, hitchhikes is perhaps a better thing. They hitchhike a ride on these monoamine transporters. And they're substrates for MAO, so MAO inhibitors make these things go up. Now, we don't know what that does or whether that has anything to do with why MAO inhibitors work, but that does happen. There's also this thing called an OCT, or an organic cation transporter, which is really what gets these things in and out of the nerve. And some drugs are trying to block that, and that would make tracheamines go up, but we're not going to talk about them. So what about those receptors, Dr. Stahl, for the tracheamines? They're called TARs, trace-amine-associated receptors. There's 6 major human ones, but the ones that we know mostly are TAR1s. They're not membrane bound, but they, just like the tracheamines themselves, just float in the cytoplasm. And they're in brain regions where there's high concentrations of monoamine neurotransmitters and glutamate, which makes you think that God put them there to actually do something and interact with them. I mean, they're naturally occurring there. So what the heck are they doing there? Well, probably something related to those things. And we're beginning to find them out. And so look at where they're located. And 2 of the red ones there at the bottom are dorsal raphe and ventral tegmental area, which make respectively which neurotransmitters? Serotonin in the raphe and dopamine in the VTA. And these other places are projections from those areas into other parts of the brain. And there are a few other receptors there, as you can see, but mostly they're red, which means TAR1. So this is beginning to look at the substrates and, the, if you will, the structure and the infrastructure of the tracheamine system, but what's the function? Well, the effects on neurotransmitters is that I told you it's where dopamine is made in VTA and substantia nigra. And I'm gonna show you in a cartoon a novel way to stop the hyperactivity of the dopamine system with a TAR1 agonist, which would be one of the tracheamines that actually acts at TAR1 receptors. And suffice it to say is that when your TAR activity goes up, by giving an agonist or actually just increasing the level of the neurotransmitter that are traced, dopamine transmission goes down. Right there, that's the key to the therapeutics I'm going to tell you about. Now, it turns out that when TAR activity is low, dopamine transmission goes up for the same reasons, and there's some idea that maybe these, the tracemines act a little bit like rheostats, or, you know, they kind of help you lower things when they're too high and raise things when they're too low. So that's beginning to be explored. TAR ones similarly are in the serotonin parts of the brain, and they decrease the firing of serotonin neurons. So guess what? You know, the 5-HT1A receptor is the one that does that, so it makes you wonder whether it might be heterodimerizing with that guy, but also it helps get this balance, like not too high, not too low, you know, the Goldilocks of the neurotransmitter system. And it may also heterodimerize, I'll tell you what that means in a minute, just with the 5-HT1B receptors. So what is heterodimerization? Well, homodimerization means two copies of the same thing. A di means two, mer means, a thing. Dimer is two mers, trimer is three mers, and if they're the same, they're monomers is what we normally talk about, one receptor by itself. You've heard that term, monomer, dimer, trimer. And so what happens is that if it turns out in the brain, although we illustrate it, guilty as charged, okay, as though they're all monomers, but the reality is sometimes these receptors are dimers and they're homodimers in that they are the same twice. And they just touch each other, they bind to each other, and they change dramatically what happens when they hug each other. It's a hug. And heterodimerization is that it's two different receptors. We don't have time to talk about it, but one of the more interesting heterodimerization theories in our field, other than the one I'm going to show you, is when NMDA receptors heterodimerize with mu opioid receptors. It may not be an accident that almost every NMDA antagonist we have is also at least a weak mu opioid agonist. And so it turns out that these things interact in the brain. We're just beginning to find out how that happens. So glutamate is the third neurotransmitter, which has the best evidence for the mono, the tracemines working at them. And they tend to prevent low glutamate states. And guess what, pop quiz, what is schizophrenia thought to be? High or low glutamate? Low. So it's basically the NMDA hypofunction hypothesis. It's thought that some receptor isn't working right on a GABA interneuron, if you remember that. And so this gives you hope that if it could compensate for too low of a glutamate, it'd help schizophrenia at the glutamate level. But the dopamine system is where we learn the most, and both PEA and tyramine are synthesized in dopamine terminals. They're not stored, I already told you that. And they diffuse across plasma membranes, but they're not released when you depolarize, and they're taken back up by this other organic cation transporter. And there also seems to be the same thing happens postsynaptically. So, you know, the monoamines only have a presynaptic transporter. These guys seem to have pre and post. And it's predominantly intracellular, not membrane. And there's the suggestion that TAR1 tonically acts to prevent too much dopamine activity, and that TAR1 agonists are a novel way to prevent overactivity by D2 receptors. Okay, does anybody know an illness where there's too much dopamine acting at D2 receptors? Okay, that's a psychosis, right? So the issue would be to look at that, but there's also this idea of correcting the hypoglutamatergic state. Perhaps this will be more for negative and cognitive symptoms, we don't know. So basically, if you've been lulled to sleep with my lullaby so far, please wake up for this slide and then you can go back to sleep again. Here we got a presynaptic dopamine neuron in blue, and it's making dopamine for a living. Tyrosine is going to TOH, which is tyrosine hydroxylase. It makes it into DOPA, DOPA into dopamine, stored into a vesicle and ready like a cock gun loaded to fire, and out will come dopamine. And what's wrong in schizophrenia? And the answer is too much dopamine in that presynaptic neuron. And so we know that there's also a D2 receptor presynaptically, and it's there as an autoreceptor to turn off further release and even synthesis of dopamine. And it goes down two signal transduction pathways. In other words, the signal from dopamine into its receptor is changed, morphed. It's a little bit like the kids' game telephone. And the next one. Or you could call it a molecular pony express. We are actually in Colorado Springs. And so the issue is whether it goes down one pathway is called beta arrestin, if you care, and another one's called inhibitory G protein, if you care. We don't actually know the reason why a neurotransmitter would choose to go down one or the other pathways quite well yet, but we're beginning to learn by things that I'm going to show you next. So here's too much, if you will, what's that? Dopamine coming out. So this person must be psychotic. And what do you and I do for 70 years to fix that too much dopamine? We take those postsynaptic D2 receptors, don't we, and we block them. We don't do anything to fix the too much synthesis. And I have a dirty little secret to tell you. See those presynaptic dopamine receptors? What happens if you stimulate them? It turns off release. I just told you that. What do you suppose happens if one of our glorious D2 antagonist drugs is given to those receptors, which of course we don't talk about, but that is happening? The drug will go both on the north side and the south side. There's D2 receptors. It's going to increase dopamine release. That's the last thing you want to do in a psychotic patient, but we do it anyway. Why? Because it's the cost of doing business. Did you ever wonder, like in the shower at night, you know, why do we have such high doses of D2 antagonists? You know, does that kind of just philosophically come across you, or, you know, during a cup of coffee, something? And the answer is because we actually have too much in the first place, and then we make it worse with our presynaptic action of the drug. We got to block every God-blessed postsynaptic receptor in order to compensate for all that. Ergo, look at all the problems. Every dopamine receptor, not only in your brain, but within a block of you is blocked by our D2 antagonist, right? So that's a huge price to pay, but, you know, it's the way we treat psychosis. It works. Now, I got another pop quiz for you. Did you know that a number of different investigators have proven that that blue neuron has too much dopamine in it when you're psychotic and unmedicated, and also when you're manic? And do you have any idea how much that dopamine is increased in order to make you psychotic? In their calculations, only about 40 to 70%. Why don't we try to stop the presynaptic dopamine from being synthesized instead of blocking the heck out of the postsynaptic side? Well, that's what the TAR story is. So you see the TAR1 agonist? It's going to be given as a drug. There's two of them in development. I'm going to give you some of the history of it quickly. It's going to go to that floating receptor in the cytoplasm there, and it's going to go, boop! It's going to translocate, which means move, to the cell membrane, and whoop! It just heterodimerized before your very eyes. Have you ever, I don't know, it's like, could be a sex act as far as I know. I'm not sure that that's a, you know, an R-rated cartoon there. And then what it's going to do is the second thing, bias the agonism towards this guy. And what does he do for a living? He shuts off dopamine synthesis. So you telling me TAR1 agonism marries a D2 receptor and shunts it such that the message is to stop dopamine synthesis? Well, what do you suppose that will do if dopamine synthesis goes down? Maybe that'll help psychosis. So let's go check it in a patient. And there's maybe some postsynaptic actions as well. So there's two in development. Relmitarant is one by Roche, also with those numbers to it. It's a partial agonist. It's currently in phase 2 for the treatment of acute exacerbation schizophrenia or schizoaffective in a randomized big trial. And it's really for the acute exacerbation in 4-week trial with the PANSS score outcome, and it also with the brief negative symptom scale outcome in a 12-week study as well. And so they're just currently recruiting. It's still in progress. So you've got the screening followed by randomization to 45, 150 placebo or an internal comparator, Risperdal. And then after the 4 weeks, it can extend for another 8, and everybody then gets relmitarant, including the placebo people, whereas the comparator goes forward. And they're going to look at, you know, what the outcomes are in terms of, does the psychosis get better? Does the side effects get better? And there's a separate trial of 12 weeks to add it on or give it as monotherapy to people with schizophrenia to check their negative symptoms. And so that's also in progress. The second one is ulotaront. Say it 3 times and then you know it. And it'll be called something else when it's a trade name, but this is basically the generic name. It's got some 5-HT1A activity, which may or may not have a lot to do with what else it does, but it doesn't have any D2 or 5-HT2A. None. Who would ever thought that you would live long enough to see the day when an antipsychotic didn't have D2 antagonism properties? And so the phase 2 study is done. It demonstrated already efficacy for positive and negative and safety in a 4-week study with acute exacerbation schizophrenia, and then they extended it for half a year with no safety concerns, which is something I'm going to show you right next. And there's right now in development, because it's in breakthrough, if it actually scores in the next year, it's very likely that it'll be filed with the FDA, whatever, in a year or so, and it could be in our hands, you know, up to as fast as a year after that. So this is why beginning to learn about this would be good, because it could be in your hands within a year or two or three, something like that. So here's the one trial I'm going to show you. It's a double blind screen, 1-to-1 randomization of flexible dosing of 50 or 75 of this new drug, ulotaront, against placebo for 4 weeks. And then they extended it for another, basically up to a half a year, and tried to look mostly at safety at this point. Okay. So who got into the trial, look carefully, it's a little bit different than they put in younger people, 18 to 40 in this trial. The phase 3 trial will be 13 to 65, but this was a first one, and so they did it at lower ages, looked at acute exacerbation psychotic symptoms, and excluded people who had been previously hospitalized. They didn't want to put treatment resistance in there. So here's the outcome. So you see it separates from placebo at week 3, and there's a huge effect size at week 4. So the separation might have been a little bit, but not significant at week 1. It doesn't separate early, so that may be something about if you ever wanted to switch someone to this or start someone, your expectations of how fast it might work. We'll have to see how that holds up in clinical trials. And this is what happens if you extended it. So there's the drug versus placebo group on the far left. Then everybody gets on drug, and then they look at the PANSS score, which is your psychosis score, right? And it not only was sustained, it got mobetta and mobetta over the time very slowly. So it looks like the response is sustained, and it's a fairly robust improvement. And then this will blow you away. Yes, this is not a fake slide. What, look at the side effects compared to placebo. A little somnolence, agitation, nausea, diarrhea, dyspepsia is about the same. Worsening of schizophrenia basically means that, that it wasn't well adjusted to the patient. There was one suicide attempt in the placebo group. And over here, look at this. Weight neutral, BMI neutral, cholesterol neutral, LDL neutral, triglycerides, glucose, hemoglobin A1C. What? If anything, it actually was, you'll see that the weight went down in long-term studies. And the other thing is, what were the 6 months open label? So half of the patients treated in the 6-month study, the ones I just showed you were the 4-week studies, had experienced an adverse event, but only headache, schizophrenia worsening, insomnia, anxiety occurred more than 5%, and this wasn't against placebo. And there were serious adverse events, were 5%, and were observed more in one patient being mostly schizophrenia worsening. And look at this. There weren't any EPS. So at 26 weeks, the rate of AEs leading to discontinuation was about 11.5%. And so very high for these kinds of studies. You're lucky if you get half of them done, but this is two-thirds. So here's another way to show it. Look at the weight change. Look at the prolactin change. It went down. Look at cholesterol, glucose over 6 months. That's not bad. Now, look at the movement disorders. EPS versus placebo, about the same. So how could that be? And the six-month extension, a little bit of some people, 5 out of 156, but there's no placebo to compare it against. So in summary, ladies and gentlemen, trisomines and their receptors appear to regulate neurotransmitter activity, including dopamine. If this went by too fast, don't worry. It's the first exposure. You got plenty of time. You got 2 years to learn it. We'll talk about it maybe next year as well. Much is yet to be learned about the trisomines, the receptor, but it does appear already that trisomines are not classical neurotransmitters, that if you stimulate or agonize TAR1 receptors, they may heterodimerize with D2 receptors and shut off dopamine synthesis presynaptically to reduce psychosis. Trisomines and TAR1s are positioned potentially to serve as rheostat of dopamine neurotransmission, and TAR1 agonists may have therapeutic effects in schizophrenia to modulate dysfunctional dopamine neurotransmission. There's a lot of speculation based on animal models and theory that these might be good in bipolar disorder, in depression, and even in anxiety disorders. And the second summary is heterodimerization is a concept where two different receptors, in this case TAR1 and D2Rs, join molecularly. Biased agonism is a concept where a neurotransmitter can bias the signal, which gets transduced, essentially translated, after a neurotransmitter gets in its receptor along a specific pathway so that the one action goes mobeta. And two agents that are TAR1 agonists have already shown promising early results in treating schizophrenia for both positive and negative symptoms. And due to their ability to regulate multiple neurotransmitters, TAR1 agonists may also be effective for other conditions, including mood disorders.